World News Today, brought to you by the Admiral Corporation, makers of Admiral Radio, America's smart set. By shortwave broadcast, direct from important overseas stations, as well as leading news centers of our own country, CBS correspondents are waiting to bring you a complete report from the world's political and battlefronts. But first, here's Doug Edwards.
American daylight raiders were back in action over the coast of France today, this time without escorting fighter planes. Last night's RAF target was Hamburg and other points in western Germany. CBS has heard the British radio report today that Russian troops have reached the Buk River southwest of Uman. In Rome, Pope Pius has marked the fifth anniversary of his accession to the throne with another appeal for peace and another appeal to all belligerents to spare Rome the horror of battle. Aside from air action, the Italian fronts are quiet. But now for news direct from that battle zone and an interview with one of our fighting men from Montana, Admiral Radio takes you to CBS Naples. John Daly reporting.
Bad visibility and a cold driving rain today restricted both land and air operations on the Italian battlefronts. There was a pause in the aerial offensive against German land transport, which has taken our bombers over Rome and several major railway cities in the last few days. A high point in the offensive was yesterday's attack, the first of the Italian campaign, against the vital railroad yards in the ancient city of Florence. Through these yards, a great percentage of the traffic from Central Europe and the Balkans clears into southern Italy. For weeks, our Air Force has been pounding at the railway cities around Florence in the desperate hope that by knocking them out, we could avoid a direct attack on Florence, a storehouse for much of the cultural and artistic heritage of European civilization. But that didn't work. And faced with the military necessity of bombing Florence, the Air Force turned to the sharpshooting B-26 Marauders. Lieutenant Jack A. Larkin of Great Falls, Montana, piloted a Marauder in yesterday's attack, an attack so successful that it brought immediate commendation from Major General John K. Cannon, commanding the tactical Air Force. Jack, how do you get ready for these precision attacks?
It begins very early in the morning, unfortunately. The lead pilots and bombardiers were called in at 6 o'clock yesterday morning and went over maps and photographs of Florence with the intelligence officers until they could almost throw away the maps of the city and find the targets from memory. At 6:45, all crews, including the lead pilots and lead bombardiers, were briefed. The intelligence officer took over, and he went back to the Middle Ages and worked right up to the present date, telling us the history and importance of all the churches and museums and palaces in Florence. After that, he blew up some photographs of the city on a 3-by-4-foot screen and spotted the location of everything which he said was not to be hit under any circumstances. The rest of the briefing was pretty normal, except that it lasted as twice as long as usual. Finally, we were given target maps, and on the back of them were photographs with the churches, museums, and palaces, and so forth, in green and yellow. And the last thing the briefing officer said was, if you think you're going to have trouble with overcast, and if you're not absolutely sure of accuracy, don't bomb.
But did everything go smoothly?
Yes and no. The weather started closing in just as we took off. All the way up to the target, it was bad, and I was quite sure we wouldn't do any bombing that day. But when we got to within 15 miles of the target, everything broke like magic, and there was Florence, CAVU.
And what is CAVU?
That means ceiling invisibility unlimited. The bombing conditions were almost perfect, and we went into the bomb run, which was approximately 4 times as long as usual, for greater accuracy.
Did you see your bombs fall?
No, I didn't. I was too busy holding an exact course, but I know that the bombing was 100% accurate and 95% destructive, and that not one bomb hit closer than 1/4 mile from any church, museum, or palace. That's precision bombing, John.
It is that, Jack. As General Cannon said, you've done it again. Now back to CBS in New York.
More news in just a moment, but first, here's Warren Sweeney with a word from Admiral Radio.
Calling Car 27, return to headquarters. Car 27, return to headquarters. If you were strolling along Piccadilly Circus in London some evening and you heard such a call, you'd probably have to look twice to be sure you weren't in America. Military police in the London area have found that a radio patrol system, as used by police departments in American cities, is of great benefit to the civilian population as well as to military personnel. In the event of an air raid, soldiers and firefighting equipment can be quickly dispatched to the affected areas. Another example of the many uses of radio in war. Admiral Communications equipment is fighting on all fronts, war-proved, battle-tested. Production facilities of all Admiral plants have been greatly expanded to build more and more radio materials so vital to victory. Admiral's post-war plans include many radio improvements developed for the needs of war. When the war is won and Admiral's efforts are turned to civilian production, you can expect great things from Admiral, America's smart set. Now here once again is Doug Edwards.
Liberator bombers have again attacked the French invasion coast. For this news and an interview with the inventor of the 6-ton bomb, Admiral Radio takes you to CBS London, Charles Shaw reporting.
American bombers have raided German targets again without opposition and without loss. The targets today were in the Pas-de-Calais area, and they were attacked by unescorted Liberators. Our forces are successful on all fronts, but of course, they owe much to the men behind the fronts, those who develop their weapons and plan their strategy and tactics. And now here is Air Commodore Patrick Huskinson, commander of the British Empire, MC and Bar, a fighter pilot in the last war, who was totally blinded in a London air raid in 1941. He heads the British Ministry of Aircraft production team, responsible for the new 12,000-pound or 6-ton aerial bomb. Air Commodore Huskinson, what is the object of such an enormous concentrated weight of explosive in your bomb?
To destroy Nazi war production, one big bomb is much better than a large number of small ones. You have recently seen the air photographs of our attack with 12,000-pound bombs on Le Bourget. These bombs completely devastated an aero engine repair factory.
Well, can you say, sir, how the 12,000-pounder came about?
The bomb was developed by a large team of scientists over many months of investigation. The first thing to consider was the aircraft to carry them and the amount of space available in the bomb bays. Once this point has been settled, the designer traces out the bomb case, the tail, the fuse, and the exploding components. Another important point is to trace the path of the bomb through the air, which has to be accurately measured in order that correct settings may be set on the bomb sites. A wooden model is then made and placed up in the mock-up in the airplane to see that it fits correctly. A further team of experts are considering what type of explosive to place in the bombs. Once this is settled, trial bombs are made up and statically detonated on the ground. The first time we dropped one of our 12,000-pounders, it fell head over heels, much to the consternation of the experts watching the trials.
Well, Air Commodore Huskinson, what can you say about the tests you make?
Bombs are placed on their nose on the ground and surrounded with a large number of scientifically recording instruments, which give blast pressure over distance. People who carry out these trials are at least half a mile away from the bomb when it detonates, and they are covered in concrete dugouts for protection. The bomb is then electrically fired and the blast measurements are taken. The first time we detonated one of our large bombs, the noise caused a big consternation throughout the district. Finally, bombs are taken up in aircraft, live, and dropped to test their true path through the air.
Well, thank you very much, Air Commodore Huskinson. I don't suppose you'd like to tell us about any new ideas you have.
No, thank you. At present, I should like to say one thing. You cannot judge the efficiency of our large bombs by their weight and size alone. It's the explosive in them that matters. Research continues.
I return you now to New York.
And now for a summary of the heavy fighting in Russia's southern Ukraine, here is Columbia's military analyst, Major George Fielding Elliott.
The crucial area of the fighting in South Russia is the front between the rail junctions of Tarnopol and Proskurov. Of these two German strongholds, both of which are being desperately defended, Proskurov is for the moment the more important. While the Germans hold it, they still have a direct supply route open between Germany and their armies on the Bug and the lower Dnieper. If they lose Proskurov, those armies become dependent on the Romanian railway system. That is, on roundabout routes of uncertain capacity and efficiency, passing through an area of uncertain political stability. But there is something more to be said about this front between Tarnopol and Proskurov. If the Russians achieve a complete breakthrough in force, the way will be open for them to cross the upper Bug and to turn southeastward into the corridor between the Bug and the Dniester in one of the great classic enveloping movements which the Russian high command has so often sought to execute with greater or less success. At Stalingrad, such a move captured a German army. And before Leningrad, a few weeks ago, two German armies were forced to retreat before such a threat. Now the greatest of these possibilities, which the war has yet offered to the Russians, lies almost within their grasp. The prize is the whole German group of armies to the south, strung out along the Bug and down to the mouth of the Dnieper, badly overextended and with precarious routes of supply. If Proskurov falls, and if the Russians break through into the Bug-Dniester corridor, just one thing can save these German armies: a heavy and successful German counteroffensive in this same Tarnopol-Proskurov region. The Wehrmacht thus faces its most severe test, and we shall soon know what its remaining defensive power may be.
That was Columbia's military analyst, Major George Fielding Elliott. And now for a report on developments in South America, Admiral Radio takes you to CBS Rio de Janeiro, John Adams reporting.
Brazilian political observers are obviously alarmed about the anti-American wedge that the Nazis and fifth colonists seem to be driving into the Pan-American bloc. Evidences of this alarm could be noted in the closely controlled Brazilian press this week. There were very few editorials directly about the Argentina and Bolivian situations, but there was a noticeable increase in strongly worded editorials advocating that close links must be maintained between Latin America and the United States. These followed a closed-door session that Foreign Minister Oswaldo Aranha had with all Rio publishers earlier in the week. Today, Associado Brian, one of the largest newspaper chain owners in Latin America and a recognized authority on inter-American politics, pointed to a new threat to Pan-American unity: the growing activity of fifth columnists in Uruguay. In his column in O Journal, Chateaubriand reported a conversation with two leaders of the nationalistic Herrerista party, and quoted one as saying, "We are anti-Yankee. We don't want to know about the United States. Our party is in the field to return Uruguay to the position of a neutral country, such as she was before Pearl Harbor." And another Herrerista stated, "Our campaign against Uruguay's foreign policy is conducted in unity of views with the government of Buenos Aires. The Argentine military group, from our point of view, represents the adequate conduct for America in the world conflict." Since similar movements are active in Paraguay, Bolivia, and Chile, there is reason for America and Brazilian diplomatic officials to be alarmed. Meanwhile, on the Brazilian domestic front, the people are tussling with the worst food shortage in years, and price inflation is making it tough going for the little man. Transport difficulties are given as the principal reason for the current shortages, but explanations do not fill empty stomachs, and there is growing discontent. The fifth column is again active and doing its best to place part of the blame on the United States, but the people on the whole scoff at such talk, for they are traditionally pro-American and pro-democratic. This is John Adams in Rio, returning you to CBS and Admiral Radio in New York.
The Germans continue to boast how well prepared they are for the invasion. For a summary of reports from inside Axis Europe, Admiral Radio takes you now to CBS Madrid, Glenn Stadler reporting.
The story of how Nazi propaganda minister Goebbels left the hotel party just a few minutes before a bomb hit, killing all his guests, was told to me today by a neutral traveler from Berlin. It was the night of February 15th. Goebbels was entertaining a group of high government officials, including army generals. They were having coffee in the salon of the Hotel Bristol on Unter den Linden. About 9 p.m., the siren sounded. Goebbels said a hurried Auf Wiedersehen, rushed to his automobile, and sped away. Already the anti-aircraft guns on the outskirts were booming at first to the RAF bombers, which were carrying 2,500 tons of bombs to unload in the very heart of Hitler's Third Reich. A blockbuster fell directly into the room where the propaganda minister's abandoned guests were gathered. The hotel literally was blown sky high. Only four persons, the chief cook, the porter, and two men standing in a doorway, escaped.
Goebbels, in the meantime, had safely tucked himself away in a bomb-proof shelter elsewhere.
9 days later, more than 1,000 bodies had been recovered, and all the wreckage had not yet been cleared.
The Bristol had followed the Adlon, Kaiserhof, and Eden hotels as a pile of debris. The Reich capital, according to the traveler, was about 70% destroyed as of March 1st. But the people argued over whether or not it was 75 or even 80% gone. The estimates there are less than 500,000 Berliners remaining, but there are about 1.5 million foreigners, mostly enforced laborers and prisoners of war, living in barracks among the ruins. He referred to the Wittenberg Platz, where Der Fuhrer's half-brother, also a Hitler, owned a restaurant, was nothing but a memory. He also said that American daylight raids were amazing in their precision. They didn't bother about the center of the city, but concentrated on outlying industrial districts, which were still operating. This is Glenn Stadler in Madrid, returning you to Admiral Radio in New York.
And now for news from the Central Pacific, Admiral Radio takes you to CBS Pearl Harbor. Webley Edwards reporting.
I have just returned from a visit to a Pacific island where much of the 4th Marine Division is now billeted. These are the men who, with 7th Army Division men, stormed ashore in the Marshall Islands. I talked and ate and spent considerable time with these men and asked them what they thought of the war and how they'd like to go home. They're thinking of home, all right. They'd like a few hours at the corner drugstore and to see their parents and their girlfriends and to loaf a little in their old haunts. But they are already looking forward to their next battle. They're very serious about this job ahead of them. They've just started this Pacific War. To leave off now would not be too much to their liking. These are the men who've just left off killing Japs in the Marshall Islands in an efficient and thorough manner. Many of us may have wondered if this cold-blooded killing of the enemy, this necessary stamping out of a brutal and fanatic enemy in his sniper's post or his pillbox, may have brutalized our young men. I have to report that it is not. They are normal young men who've been through a terrific experience, but their afterthoughts are perfectly decent. They remind you a lot of a crowd of young men who've just returned from an important football game, which they've won, except that these have a very serious look in their eye. They are quite tough, in the quiet, tough way of men who know their own strength and support. This does not submerge their sense of humor, the irrepressible flow of typical American wisecracks. This toughness is most heartening. It is not the brash, superficial gangster kind. It's a toughness that comes from the knowledge that they must do a job of killing when it's called for. When the job is done, they turn again to the kind of young men that you and I know and like. Much of this is the result of excellent leadership. Let me give you an example. On this Pacific island, this was posted, and the 4th Marines were reading and heeding it. I quote, "When on liberty or duty ashore, all Marines will strictly obey all rules in force in this area. All officers will be saluted. No knives or weapons will be carried. Proper uniform will be worn. Clean khaki with field scarf and garrison cap. Hair will be cut and appearance will be neat. Enlisted Army and Navy personnel have established a good reputation during their stay on this island. Marines will so conduct themselves in the dealings with the local people so as not to be out of order. Combat experience does not allow anyone to let down the bars. Discipline and respect for the uniform and for others is still the mark of the Marine anywhere." Unquote. This is Webley Edwards at Pearl Harbor, returning you to Admiral Radio in New York.
And now for the news at home and an interview with the commander of a Navy patrol squadron in the South Atlantic, Admiral Radio takes you to CBS Washington, Don Pryor reporting.
The Irish question is still the most explosive subject in Washington today, but there have been no new developments. The only thing that can be said so far is that a much sterner attitude toward error seems to be inevitable. Debate on extension of the Price Control Act will get underway next Wednesday at a hearing called by the Senate Banking Committee, and moves probably will be made both to fix a ceiling on wages and to lift the subsidy control over prices. And in the process, legislators expect to make a thoroughgoing checkup of the whole stabilization machinery. You haven't heard very much about it, but there's been a bitter war going on in the South Atlantic, a war against submarines and blockade runners and against the devious activities of Axis agents. The front line in that battle zone is in the air, with the officers and crews of Navy Liberators, Mariners, Catalinas, and Venturas that scour the ocean to find and kill the enemy. To tell you about it, Admiral Radio brings you the commander of the most deadly patrol squadron in that area, just back in this country after 2 years of service over the South Atlantic. He is Lieutenant Commander Renfro Turner, Jr. of Memphis, Tennessee.
That's quite a build-up, Don. Actually, we've just been doing a routine job. We've been pretty successful, but I want to make it plain that no one person deserves any more credit than anyone else.
Oh, sure.
No, I'm very serious about it. That's the kind of job it is. The most important part of it is just plain looking. You can't sink a submarine until you see it, and you can't see one without looking hard and long. And every member of the crew shares the lookout job.
Well, can you tell us the story of one of your actual attacks, Commander?
Well, one of the most exciting ones came during a training flight. We were out in the Liberator flying around 8,700 feet. We came out of the top of a cloud when Ensign Rohr, the navigator in the bow, sighted the submarine on the surface.
You were flying the ship?
Yes. We ducked back into the clouds so he wouldn't see us and went down to about 4,000 feet. Then we came out of the cloud and dove and dropped a depth charge from about 50 feet just as his stern was going under the water.
Did that get him?
I think it damaged him. We patrolled around for about an hour, and he came back to the surface. That time, Ensign Terry, the co-pilot, was flying, and he made a second attack just as the periscope was going down. We had to go back to the base then, so we called in some other planes, and they kept patrolling all night. He came up again at dawn. The plane that sighted him made one attack, and then two more came in and dropped half a dozen depth charges apiece and blew him to bits. Unfortunately, one of the planes was caught in the explosion and was lost.
Well, how much of the South Atlantic can you cover like that, Commander?
All of it.
And how about the blockade work you do down there?
Well, you've read about Germany's attempts to run the blockade.
Well, I remember that story in January when four of their ships were sunk. Were you involved in that one?
Yes, all of us were. We set up a barrier patrol clear across the Atlantic. It was so effective that not a single ship got through that we didn't see.
Well, one of them got up to the Bay of Biscay, didn't it?
Yes, I'm sorry to say he did. He slipped away from us after we spotted him, but the British caught him later and sent him down along with several destroyers the Germans sent out to help him. But the other three were scuttled in the South Atlantic when our surface ships closed in on them.
Well, the South Atlantic apparently is pretty well under control, under the overall command of Vice Admiral Jonas Ingram. And now Commander Turner is going to get a well-earned period of service here at home where he can watch his one-and-a-half-year-old daughter grow up. I return you now to Admiral Radio in New York.
Once again, here is Warren Sweeney with a word from Admiral Radio.
Thank you, Mr. Edwards. Even the war has not lessened America's appreciation of good music. And the proud owners of Admiral Radio phonograph combinations with automatic record changers have more opportunity to indulge this appreciation. Whether the recording be the latest popular interpretation of Mersey Dotes or a Brahms concerto, the round fullness of tone and the flawless reproduction, when played on an Admiral, afford the utmost in music enjoyment. Loading and unloading the Admiral automatic changer is so simple. With a capacity of 12 records, a complete program can be enjoyed without going near the instrument. Remember, too, that only Admiral has slide away. Admiral's slide away is constructed so that by merely opening the doors of the Admiral cabinet, the complete phonograph turntable and automatic record changer emerge to view, waist high, convenient. It's easy to see why Admiral's automatic record changer and Admiral's slide away offer so many advantages over other types. For Admiral Corporation is the world's largest manufacturer of radio phonograph combinations with automatic record changers. Experience counts. And because of this experience, you'll want your post-war radio phonograph to be an Admiral, America's smart set, with the Admiral automatic record changer and Admiral slide away. The appearance of personnel of the armed services on this program does not constitute an endorsement of our product. Once again, you are asked to give generously, to give all you possibly can to the Red Cross. Let your goodness of heart be the measure of your contribution. Every dollar means blood plasma to save lives, comfort and care for the wounded, medicine and food for prisoners. America's Red Cross goal is $200 million. Your contribution is vitally needed. Make it as large as you can. World News Today is brought to you each Sunday at this hour by the Admiral Corporation, makers of Admiral Radio, America's smart set. Be sure to listen again next Sunday when Admiral brings you World News Today by shortwave, direct from leading news centers of the world. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
The WBBM Air Theater, Wrigley Building, Chicago.